Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to start off with a couple of stories about how doctors mess up and do things that they shouldn't be doing. First one is talking about stents. Now, stents are these little Chinese finger trap devices that people put into a artery, usually in a heart, although sometimes in other arteries, to open it back up in the event of a heart attack. But stents are also used widely for angina, and they're sometimes placed preventatively in people with blocked coronary arteries that maybe are having problems with exercise. Now, it's been known for quite some time that this practice, while it may improve the person's symptoms of chest pain, may not really have an effect on their long-term risk of heart attack. This latest study was done in England. Imperial College of London actually did a placebo study, and these are hard to find. In science, we have several levels of what we consider to be, let's call it grade, jumbo, grade AA, grade A, grade B. You know, just like your eggs, right? Well, you got your jumbo super science, and that's the placebo-controlled trial, where neither the doctors nor the patients have any idea whether they're getting the active agent or not. And that's the double-blind. And then the triple A eggs are, or a triple A science in our metaphor here. Well, that's the single blind, where you do the placebo, but the patient, the doctor knows, but the patient doesn't. That's what this was. They actually got 200 people to agree to this. These were people who had chest pain, blocked coronary artery, and it was getting in the way of their physical activity. So they took a 6-week course of drugs to lower the risk of a heart attack and to relieve the chest pain. Then they had an operation, but only some of them actually had a stent inserted in their artery. The others thought they had the stent inserted. And then 6 weeks later, the groups were tested, and they were pretty much equivalent. They both said they had less chest pain. They showed, and this is important, similar levels of improvement on their treadmill tests. And so you can make the argument that maybe we shouldn't be putting in stents without doing a prolonged drug trial, say, 2 or 3 months of drugs before we go intervening with a device that may not mean anything to the patient's function, but certainly means something to the pocketbook of the healthcare system. Now, of course, that's not my money, right? That's what you're thinking. Medicare is going to pay for that. Or their insurance is going to pay for that. But hey, it's a closed system. So where's that money come from? Well, it comes from raises that you didn't get from your employer because they were too busy paying for increased healthcare rates. And it comes from tax dollars at work, my friends, because that's what funds Medicare. And I'm not going to get into taxes. Please do not call to discuss taxes. I am not trying to push that button, but I do want to go on to our next story of healthcare, maybe a little bit more than you actually need. This one's about bisphosphonate therapy. This is a drug that's often given to people with osteoporosis, many more given to women than to men because it's a more common disease in women. But bisphosphonates actually are a double-edged sword because of the way that they freeze the bone metabolism in place. They prevent bone from being broken down, and that's great for a while. But over time, bone needs to be broken down and rebuilt in order to maintain its strength. Now, you've all done this in your life when you were bored, taken a paperclip and bent it back and forth and back and forth at the hinge until it broke. You're looking at metal fatigue when that happens. Well, bones get calcium's effectively a metal on the periodic table. You get calcium metal fatigue in your bones. And so those little cells that crawl around like Pac-Man eating the bones and the other cells that crawl around behind them laying down new bone, well, the imbalance between those that creates osteoporosis is stopped by the drug. But unfortunately, if you don't break down bone, well, you don't get to build it back up. Research now shows that if you stay on a bisphosphonate for more than, well, we're going up with about 5 years is our number here. But after 5 years, you start to see more fractures. So compared with 2 years of bisphosphonate use, if you take it for 10 years, you're going to actually have a statistically significant risk of more fractures, about a 30% increase in fracture risk. And that goes up. If you get above 13 years, it's 1.66 or 60% increased, and vertebral fractures as well as hip fractures start to go up in that group. So you don't get additional benefit between 3 and 5 years compared with just 2 years of use. We really got to rethink this bisphosphonate business. We might actually be giving people more fractures with long-term use. Now, of course, there's an economic incentive to stay on a drug, and there's also a economic incentive for doctors to keep them on the drug. And it's not the one you think. It's not because they're getting a kickback from big pharma. The big reason the doctors feel like they need to keep patients on drugs is because the last thing that got changed is the thing that's going to get blamed. And if I take you off of 3 or 4 unnecessary drugs, well, and something goes wrong, it's going to be because it's going to be the last thing that happened. And there's going to be a tendency to blame the doctor. Doctors are very blame adverse. And it's really, really difficult to have the guts to take an older person off of a bunch of drugs that they probably don't need. The system also fights you majorly on this, I might add. I have had such a time getting an older gentleman who's a patient of mine off of his bladder drugs. For his prostate, right? Well, he has a catheter now that's going to be in there for the rest of his life. He doesn't need any prostate drugs, but every time I stop them, somebody goes to the pharmacy and refills them. He's got visiting nurses, he's got home health people, and one way or another, I basically have to go in there and keep throwing this stuff away so that he doesn't keep getting an unnecessary drug, one of which actually has potential cardiac side effects that can cause arrhythmias. I can't get that drug stopped. It's an uphill battle, and I'm not the only one. I'm just really stubborn, so I just keep pushing. We're going to jump to an email now. Let's talk about a letter from Gina in Montana. Gina writes, sending you gratitude for your dedicated service. I've been using the lion's mane mushroom extract you recommended for 4 months and have obtained significant relief from menopausal hot flashes. The improved cognitive benefits have been a bonus. I'll be taking an employment drug screen in a few weeks, and I'm wondering if lion's mane metabolites will be detected. Lion's mane is a food and not a psilocybin mushroom, but I'm still concerned. Should I stop taking the extract prior to the test? And if yes, how long in advance? If I miss one dose now, the hot flashes come roaring back, so I really don't want to stop taking it. Well, Gina, you should be not at all worried about the drug screen that you're going to get from the employer. Worry about decongestants. Stay away from cold medications. Also, certain things like, they call it Mormon tea. It's ephedra. Sometimes people use that for its decongestant properties or for weight loss. And certainly stay away from any of those weight loss drugs. Those might test positive for amphetamines. The urine tox screen checks for a lot of things, amphetamines, barbiturates, opiates, of course, cannabis, of course, PCP, ecstasy, and they've thrown in a few things. They now check for bath salts and some sorts of synthetic cannabinoids that are making the rounds out there. Humanity's got lots of ingenuity, I must say that, when it tries to get high. Basically, don't worry about the lion's mane. It will not show up on a drug test, and it doesn't contain any psychoactive substances that are going to get you in trouble. Our next email from Kelly in Ohio. Kelly writes, Dear Dr. Dawn, I heard your recent info on proton pump inhibitors, and I wanted to know what someone with a hiatal hernia can do to survive without proton pump inhibitors. I'm going off PPIs for a while. I tried going off them for a while, and I could not eat or drink, not even water, without suffering a burn. I tried betaine, lemon water, vinegar, and it all made me feel worse. Eventually, I went back on the PPIs and later found out that I have a hiatal hernia. I'd like to get off these meds, but I don't know how to do it without suffering the same burn that I had before. Well, Kelly, if you go to my website, askdrdawn.com, you'll find in the resources a link to a page called Tapering Off Proton Pump Inhibitors. Anyone who's ever had a bad case of gastritis or esophagitis will have noted how difficult it is to get off of the proton pump inhibitors after you've been on them for a while. This actually is due to one of the side effects of these drugs. They make you grow more acid-producing cells. It takes from 6 months to a year of use for that to happen, but it's a thing. And after you make more acid producing cells, you're obviously going to need to try to suppress that acid or make yourself have a stronger stomach lining. A lot of the instructions in there will help you. There's a substance called DGL, and this is a type of licorice that's had the substance that makes your blood pressure go up removed, and this DGL is a soothing coating for the lining of the esophagus and helps protect it against acid reflux. Other things that are on that list are making sure that you don't wear a tight belt. Particularly people with a hiatal hernia need to stay upright for 2 hours after eating. You really have to lie down with an empty stomach, or whatever's in there is just going to like pop right out like an empty bottle dropped on the ground. It starts to drop its contents, but in this case, it'll be into your esophagus. Other things that I want to mention, there's a drug called metoclopramide. The trade name of that is Reglan, R-E-G-L-A-N, now available as a generic. Low doses of that, like 5 milligrams with food, can really help with preventing the reflux up into the esophagus. So another good strategy for you. There is also a surgery for hiatal hernia. This is better than a proton pump inhibitor. It's a Nissen fundoplication. If you think about it like a bladder lift, it's very similar. It'll last for a minimum of 10 years. After that, you might need another little tweak to it. But 10 years of relief off of proton pump inhibitors means a lower risk of pneumonia and a lower risk of neuropathy and a lower risk of osteoporosis, all of which you are otherwise at risk for by taking proton pump inhibitors for more than about 6 months, and particularly if you take it for that 10 years. So sometimes in medicine, we have a risk versus benefit that we think about. In my view, the risk and the benefit issues are pretty clear here. And what I would suggest you do is go down to the health food store and look for that DGL. Go to my website, askdrdawn.com. Find that cheat sheet on getting off proton pump inhibitors. Take them. Take it easy. Take it slow. Do all of the things that are suggested on that. And elevate the head of your bed, by the way. Get some 4x4s and lift that up about, 8 inches if you can manage it. If you lift the whole bed up, it makes a big difference because now your stomach is downhill from your esophagus. And gravity flow, my friend, well, gravity is the ultimate arbiter of which direction things are going to head. It all comes down eventually. Ask Isaac Newton. This one about the healing and life-prolonging properties of dogs. This comes from a very large study in Sweden. 3.4 million people between the ages of 40 and 80. They got demographic data on them. I guess the census in Sweden also finds out whether or not you own a dog, because they found that for those who live alone, owning a dog is associated with a 33% lower risk of death and a 36% lower risk of dying from heart disease over a 12-year period. That's how long that's the distance between censuses, I guess. They also found that if you didn't live alone, there was an 11% mortality improvement. But it's unclear why. Okay, it might be the companionship and the emotional support might be the walking around. You know, obviously you get more exercise if you have to take the dog out for a walk. But there's also the possibility that the microbiome might be playing a role here, so that exposure to the dog's germs, fur, and slobber, as they put it in the article, could increase the strength of the immune system. And I'm actually pretty clear that there could be something big there as far as the immune system is concerned. I've got another microbiome story right here, and this one related to gut microbes protecting against high blood pressure. Now, in this study, researchers started out with mice, and they fed the mice a higher salt diet than they usually had. And they were looking for changes in something called Th17 cells. These are white blood cells that regulate other white blood cells. And Th17 cells are widely considered to be pro-inflammatory, meaning that they rev up the immune response. And so that can be a little bit bad because it can raise inflammation, and inflammation can cause all kinds of things, including higher blood pressure. So they found that, yes, indeed, when they fed the mice higher amounts of salt, Th17 cells dropped, and they found that it had to do with the population of a bacteria called Lactobacillus marinus. They found that the mice had fewer of these bacteria, and there was a direct connection between the number of bacteria and the number of the inflammatory cells and the blood pressure in the mice. So then they gave those same mice that they'd already messed up the bacterium, the Lactobacillus marinus, and the blood pressure went down and the T17 cells went down. So then they decided, well, let's try this in humans. I'm glad that the mice went first. The humans got 6,000 milligrams. That's about a teaspoon of salt per day for 2 weeks. And yes, indeed, the composition of the bacteria in the gut changed and the blood pressures went up and their Th17 cells went up as well. They then fed them a commercially available probiotic for a week before doing it on a different group of humans kept them on it. And in those cases, the lactobacillus levels remained stable and the blood pressure remained normal in those humans. So I'd say that's pretty good science, even though it's not necessarily a double-blind placebo-controlled study. I think it's pretty good science, and I'm inclined to tell you if you've got blood pressure issues, you should probably be taking a probiotic. Shoot for about 10 billion or 20 billion colony-forming units of a variety of lactobacillus, because it won't hurt you and it might actually help. So we're going to go to our first caller of the day. And the number, by the way, is 479-1080. So let's go clicking here and talk to Richard in Felton. Hello, Richard.
Hello. I just want to say really quick, I have the hiatus and all that kind of stuff in my stomach and GERD. And the only thing I have ever felt that ever relieved it was proton pump inhibitors. So it is a useful device. I know maybe you are able to work around it. I'm going to study everything you have to say about it, but I'll just leave it at that. People should be able to take PPIs and still settle your stomach. Mm-hmm. But my real question was, your normal host, she mentioned she had chronic fatigue syndrome. I was wondering if you could mention anything that you've learned over the years about that.
Well, sure, Richard, but before I launch into that, let me just say I use proton pump inhibitors all the time. I just don't use them forever. I try to keep people on them for a couple of weeks, get things healed in there, and then get to the bottom of what's going on. And if there is a hiatal hernia, you know, many people have silent hiatal hernias that don't bug them at all. So there's a whole bunch of things that you can do, including behavioral and milder versions of blockers that don't block so much. I think the problem with the proton pump inhibitors is they take away 90% of your acid, And I think you need, especially around your meals, some acid to absorb the nutrients. If we can give people, say, a half a cup of apple cider vinegar or some betaine hydrochloride, which is hydrochloric acid tablets or capsules, around their meals, well, then they absorb the B12 and they absorb the calcium, so they don't get the long-term problems. Sometimes you can, that's the compromise I have to make with my folks, but everything has consequences. And since we know that these drugs, if we don't also take measures to avoid it, are going to affect people's nutrition and cause them problems long-term, you know, we need to know that and address it. Now, coming to the chronic fatigue, this is a complex issue, so I'm going to give you sort of the what we call the executive summary. It makes you feel good. If I say the Cliff's Note version, that makes you feel like a kid in school who didn't do his homework. But if I say the executive summary, well, doesn't that sound better? Anyway, so chronic fatigue syndrome is a situation where people have a feeling of tiredness and fatigue. Some people who have this are absolutely unable to get out of bed for days at a time. They're completely disabled by it. Others kind of slog through their days and then collapse in a heap and get up the next 16 hours later and do it again as long as they can. And there are numerous different things that will lead to a situation of chronic fatigue. And when we are trying to make that diagnosis clinically, like let's suppose we're trying to do some science on it, we want to be sure that we don't include people who are just tired or depressed in our science group. We want the people who've really got the syndrome. We can look for upregulation, that is to say, increased levels in the bloodstream of certain inflammatory markers. Now, these are not the usual things that you would check in a person, let's say, who went for a physical. Sometimes they'll have normal levels of the HSCRP, which is the only inflammatory markers most doctors know to look for, but they'll have higher levels of things like transforming growth factor, beta. They'll have higher levels of interferon and inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-10, and those can all be measured as well. It's just not something that's typically done in clinical medicine. I always get into trouble with my staff because I'll come back from a conference and start ordering these crazy tests, and they're all there for a reason, but then I have to argue with the insurance companies because they're quote-unquote experimental. Anyway, that's another story. Getting back to chronic fatigue, it's an extremely difficult thing to live with, but one of the real hallmarks of the disease is what we call push crash. So you'll feel a little better one day. Not great, but well enough to go to maybe do the laundry and go to the grocery store along with whatever else you normally manage. And the next day, you are wiped out and wiped out majorly for days to come. And that's a circumstance that is sort of diagnostic. When I get that history from people, I know I'm dealing with a real chronic fatigue and a real energy problem. Ultimately, when we test what's going on with the mitochondria, we find that people with chronic fatigue literally are not getting the same gas mileage out of their food that a normal person gets. Their mitochondria don't make as much ATP per gram of input, a program of food, they don't get as much mileage out of it. So it's like driving around with the emergency brake on. You know what that does to your gas mileage? Well, that's what does to these people's energy levels. They feel toxic. They feel poisons. Their brains often don't work well. And that's because the way you feel when you're coming down with the flu, that's chemical. And those chemicals are inflammatory cytokines circulating in your bloodstream that are there to help fight an infection, which in the case of chronic fatigue doesn't exist. That's the inflammatory response stuck on full steam ahead in a circumstance that no longer warrants it. Sometimes this can be caused by the bite of a tick. Sometimes it can be caused by mold. Sometimes it can be caused by lead or mercury poisoning or other heavy metal exposures. And all of them look exactly the same, which is why it's been so hard to unravel this particular ball. Some people get better taking things that modify the immune system. I have a lot of people with chronic fatigue trying something called low-dose naltrexone. High-dose naltrexone is something that we use to treat opiate overdose. And nowadays, you see, if you've been watching discussions about the opiate crisis, all the cops are walking around with auto-injectors of this stuff or a closely related compound, naloxone, in order to rescue people from overdose. But this is at a much, much lower dose, almost like a hormone in the way it affects the immune system. The immune system, by the way, is covered with opiate receptors, which is why, you know, exercise also affects the immune system. If you exercise too hard, you'll depress your immune system. You'll have that naloxone-like effect. So as you can see, it's a really complicated issue. And before you can treat it, you need to figure out exactly what's triggering it and remove anything that might be perpetuating it. And that can be quite a job. And it's been hard to do good science on this because you've got four different sources of the problem and they look identical.
One follow-up question?
You bet.
Epstein-Barr virus as a causal agent for CFS.
It faked us out. I'll tell you, that was the yuppie flu back in the 80s. And remember I said people have high levels of these cytokines. Well, they also have higher levels of antibodies to some of the viruses. And EBV, that's the virus that causes mononucleosis. Most of us caught it in junior high or high school and had a light case of it. You test most people, you'll find very low levels of positive antibody, immunity, in other words, against it. But in people who develop chronic fatigue, they will have higher levels, levels that you would typically see in the case of an infection. And they might have three or four different things. If you go looking, they'll often also have cytomegalovirus, and they might have actually some autoimmune proteins. If you look, you might find that they have anti-thyroid antibody, even though they have a normal thyroid.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Epstein-Barr virus, if you research chronic fatigue syndrome, and I went multiple different medical libraries, research everything about chronic fatigue syndrome, because I have had it.
Mm-hmm.
It completely disabled me. Completely disabled me. So what I went back and researched, it all went back to the Epstein-Barr virus. It's an incapacitating virus. The CIA use it. Sorry about that. I have to say it. It's completely true. Epstein-Barr virus, if you don't have it, it's an incapacitating agent. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, what you're saying is if you are not immune and I give you the drug, you'll get mono. And you'll be sick, and you'll have weakness and fatigue. Yeah, that's true. How would you know? I mean, there's a couple of problems with it in terms of weaponizing it, just practically speaking, because such a large percentage of any randomly chosen population would have it. You'd have to get a blood sample in advance and check for antibodies and confirm that the person did not have immunity. Just like we would do with chickenpox, for example. And with an adult, you know, we might, like if I want to go to work in pediatrics and I don't have a clinical history of chickenpox, I can either take the vaccination or I can take a blood test and prove I've got antibodies. So, I mean, you could do it that way. And then if you knew that, you could weaponize it and give it to the person.
Hold on, but
I don't think you could. Well, I'm just saying, practically speaking, I mean, the Army tries a lot of crazy things. They don't always pan out.
Hold on, I'm listening.
I'm letting you talk.
Hold on a second. I'm telling you the way it actually happens, okay? I'm not making anything up. I don't have no stock and no military, nothing.
You're starting to get a little bit, how shall I put this? We're not having a conversation anymore. So I'm going to give you a chance to give me your declarative sentences, and then we're, okay, so you've got like a minute. Go for it.
Wow, isn't that interesting? What did I say to make that where I can only talk for a minute?
Well, your time is running low. For one thing, this is not a political show, and you're talking about the CIA. For another thing, you're making assertions, and you're telling me that you went to the library and found this.
Okay, one more minute, then I'll go. Look it up. infectious diseases, emerging infectious diseases, David Hemmerich. You can look it up. The back of a car, the CIA had smallpox. They're supposed to get rid of it, but they didn't get rid of it. I'm a researcher, just like you. Just like you. I'm a researcher. I don't care about nothing else. I don't care. Don't make no money. But the fact that you cover up for what the military and the CIA does, go for it.
All right, thank you. Okay, well, that's the first abusive call I've had on this station. I've never been accused of being a minion of the CIA before, but hey. Okay, we're back, and we have another caller. This one is Dave in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi there, Dr.
Hi.
I'd like to talk a little about low-dose naltrexone, because you had mentioned that.
Yes, do you have some experience with it personally?
I do. I learned about it about a decade ago, and I've been taking it nightly for about 10 years now. And my immune system, my health has been extremely good since I've been taking it. And I didn't have a diagnosable condition when I learned about it. I was healthy. But my immune system has improved significantly since taking it. And now I've got friends and people I know who've had various immune system problems who take low-dose naltrexone, and it's helpful in a wide range of conditions. I'm really impressed by it. It's really such an alternative thing, you know, because it's cheap and inexpensive, and basically the side effect is what triggers the stronger immune system response, because it generates more endorphins.
Right. It's I'm not sure what the actual mechanism is. I haven't delved that deep into it. In general, I think we need to use a little bit of caution, and I'm not really recommending the people who don't actually have a disease process that they need to treat use it as a tonic, which is what you're doing. I think that's just precautionary principle at large. I think it needs to be.
I'm just talking about my own experience. I'm
sure.
Not recommending anything.
Sure, exactly.
But
I want to be careful I want to be careful that we make that clear. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, great. I do know the mechanism because, you know, when somebody's on a dose of heroin, they give them 50 milligrams.
That's right.
And it completely blocks those receptor sites for opiates and for endorphins. But if you take a minute amount of those, like say 4 milligrams of that drug at night, when your body produces its own endorphins, it rests on a few of your receptor sites. And so the body gets sort of goes, oh, I'm a little low on these things. I'll kick up production. And when that happens, my own experience was my mood improved and I haven't had the flu since.
Well, that's a really interesting story. And again, you know, we'd start out with exactly what you're giving us, an anecdote. And from there, you know, we try to turn it into a therapy. You end up having to do some studies. But again, this thing is FDA approved at a high dose. So it makes you feel a little bit more comfortable about taking it at a low dose. But, you know, of course, nobody ever studied it over 10 years' time. I wonder as I do.
There is lots of research. Actually.
Yeah, no, it's not good research.
I have to go to the website.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good research. I have been to some of the websites, David. And here's the study I want. Okay, and it doesn't exist yet. Okay, here's the study I want. I want a group of people, a large group. Let's say 5 or 10,000, and I want half of them to be on it for 10 years, and I want the other half to be taking something that looks just like it but isn't it. And then I want to track not just their influenza. I want to track their cancer rate. I want to track whether or not, because a lot of these new immune modulating agents that we do have out for things like rheumatoid arthritis, 10 years later, where, oops, you know, there's more leukemia in the people using those drugs. I want to be sure there's not a joker in the deck, so to speak, because the, you know, long term is really different than short term. Now, if you've got a disease, well, then you've got an easy risk-benefit equation. You know, if you have to ask me, would I rather have my, would I take a risk of leukemia or be crippled by rheumatoid arthritis? I know my answer, You know, I'll take the leukemia risk and being able to walk and pet my dog and lift my child up. I'll take quality of life over quantity. I think most rational people would. But I'd like to know that I'm getting the benefit that merits the risk, you see?
So, well, sure, of course. Those kind of studies are impossible in today's pharmaceutical industry because there's no money in that kind. There's no money being made in that, in the drug itself.
Right. I understand. Yeah, you're right. I'm totally with you. That is, there's no money, there's no reason for anybody to fund it, except if the NIH was run by actual scientists who were not so influenced by...
The concept.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I'm an optimist. But, you know, we spend a lot of money in this country that we could put to better use. And one of it would be doing real science on alternative medicine. And we had actually an office of alternative medicine in the NIH that was supposed to do things like that. But under Bush the Second, and subsequently the people who've been running that office have... they've had mission creep, and now they're no longer doing the things that I would love to see them do, which is look at the stuff that grows on trees and grows on dog turds, as far as that's concerned, and finding out if we can weaponize those against chronic disease. But
wow.
I sense that I am preaching to the choir here. So thank you so much for your call and your discussion.
All right, thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Okay, a couple of bits of practical advice at this point. Just some practical advice. You wouldn't have necessarily thought this was true, but it turns out that if you have dermatitis or contact dermatitis or you have sensitive skin, you're way better off with bar soaps than with liquid soaps. Most of the body washes that are commercially available contain a ton of other compounds, preservative allergens, surfactant allergens, something like 10 times more on the average than your typical bar soap. There's a big difference there. And the most common allergens don't even exist in bar soap. So if you're having problems with your skin or rashing or itching, you might think of just going to a nice, gentle bar soap and using that instead of whatever fancy body wash hypoallergenic that you're using. Just might work a little bit better. Also, at this dermatology conference that I am reading the extracts from, there was an interesting article talking about the face microbiome in acne. And some of the interesting tidbits, we have about 500 bacterial species that live on healthy skin, and altogether they express more than 2 million different genes, and these have an influence on what goes on in our body. Furthermore, there's, you know, we talk about climate change. Well, your body has its own microclimates, your armpits versus your crotch versus your elbow. They're all very different, top of your head, forehead, and some are exposed to light, some are not. This affects what microbes grow there, and they're quite different depending upon the local climate conditions. But people who have acne, and this I think particularly important to think of for adult acne sufferers, if you look at their microbiome, they have many, many fewer bacteria species on their skin, which isn't too surprising since a lot of what we try to do for acne reduces the bacteria count. But some of what we're doing for acne may actually encourage the growth of particular strains of the P. acnes virus, which is associated with the worse acne. It's not all of the skin flora are bad. Some of them are protective. And oddly enough, the inflammation that we see may come because the bacteria are able to convert, certain species of them have the DNA to convert our own bacterial fatty acids, the sebum that we put out, our skin oil. If you break that down in a certain way, it can actually be pro-inflammatory. Another interesting study from this, people who receive retin A and antibiotics actually end up with more bacteria on their facial skin after treatment. Not understood why this is. It's completely paradoxical. But their acne, how well the acne responds to the therapy, tracks with the increased diversity. And it may very well be that the retin A is acting as a probiotic for the good flora that you need on your skin to reduce your chances of acne. Now, how about that? I can just see in 3 to 5 years a commercial probiotic that, or maybe some prebiotic that doesn't require a prescription, that encourages the growth of the bacteria that will prevent your acne rather than trying to clean up all of the bacteria on your skin. A completely impossible feat, I might add. Let's go to Carla in Watsonville. Hello, Carla.
Hi, how are you, Dr. Dawn?
Just fine. Glad to hear from a woman.
Oh, good. a woman without too many issues, hopefully. So I'm a dental hygienist, and I was approached by a patient to come to a talk about ozone therapy, and in particular for oral care, but you know, I know there's other applications, and I'm just really curious to know your opinion about this particular therapy, if there's any value in it.
I think there probably is. It's been a alternative therapy for a long time, but it's kind of been up and coming lately. I don't know. Things have come into vogue, go out of vogue in medicine as well as in other areas of human endeavor. So ozone's quite toxic to bacteria. Hospitals have used ultraviolet and ozone to eliminate bacteria for a very, very long time, probably going back to the 30s. But recent advances in technology have made it easier to produce ozone in a controlled fashion so that it can be used topically. And one place that makes a great deal of sense is in dental pockets, right? When people have deep pockets around their teeth, they've got a ton of anaerobic bacteria down there, and what you're doing is somewhat akin to making the altering the environment. You're not going to ever sterilize the mouth, but you can, if you can reduce the pockets of bacteria and destroy the biofilms, which allow, I mean, you of course spend your life scraping biofilm off people's teeth. That's what plaque is. But getting down in those deep pockets, you can't really get in there correct but properly, and so the ozone will probably help quite a bit. I think the new technology that I was referring to allows you to have a little ozone producing wand so that you can get it in there. I think that would surprise me if somebody isn't doing a study. At least even the company that makes the wands would make complete sense to me for them if they want to get broad acceptance of this. It's easy to do a placebo study. You just have the device turned on or not, and you give free treatments to people, and then you could flip them over halfway through. And yeah, I mean, I could design the study that would show validation, and you could probably get volunteers to do it. Even a small study, I think, would go a long way to getting acceptance among the general dental world. And it wouldn't surprise me if you go to that talk that in fact they tell you about such a study. And if they do, well, please send me that information. I'd be very interested. You know, I can only surf on the medical literature.
Right. Well, that's it. I mean, the only reference that could be given to me was through YouTube, and that's not scientific enough.
Well, yeah, that's a testimonial, and what we need to do is realize that, you know, you can't disregard testimonials because just like the fellow who called earlier with the LDN, that's part of our hypothesis generation is if you get enough testimonials, you're like, wow, we need to really look at this. This could, you know, we might want to validate and promote this. And it would, and that, anything we can do that is local. Now, I have people who are using ozone. Sometimes I go to conferences that are very alternative, and I'll run into people who are, you know, I can't really decide whether they're wearing an aluminum hat or whether they're like right at the cutting edge of what might be, you know, in 20 years, standard of care. And the guy who came up with antibiotics for treating ulcers, getting rid of H. pylori, is that, you know, he was treated like a guy with a tin hat by his medical colleagues, and he almost lost his medical license because nobody could believe his research until, and it's like, well, no, he's not faking it. It's real. Somebody has to replicate it, and then somebody else has to replicate it. And then people start going, yeah, you know, maybe we need to think about this. And that's, I think, where ozone is right now. It needs it needs some science to get general general acquiescence that it's good. But, you know, nowadays every community has a hyperbaric oxygen chamber for treating wounds. And I send my cancer patients for hyperbaric oxygen if I think the oxygen can get to the cancer. I believe that oxygen is toxic to cancer cells. There's ample evidence it is. And if I can get a high enough level in somebody's cell. But 10 years ago, this was just not a thing. And it wasn't even accepted for wound healing until the studies came out and people became convinced.
Well, it'll be interesting. You know, I believe if my patient does continue to use it, then that should be visible. It's been touted to repair carious lesions on the tooth. So that should be something that I could easily document.
Exactly. I think that's pretty far-fetched because obviously you'd have to rebuild tooth, and I don't think you can rebuild tooth. So that's where, you know, so there's a grain of truth there maybe, but there's also, you know, hooey.
it seems like it was such a fix-all for just about anything, and that's when it starts making me question.
Yeah, well, it should make you itch between the shoulder blades at that point. But you can't throw it all away. You have to say, all right, let's examine, let's look at what's plausible. Let's examine the plausible mechanism, and let's see how that can be, can we make it actionable in a way that's better than what we're currently doing? Because let's always remember, what we're doing ain't too bad, but if we can, but the ones that we can't help or the diseases that we can't really get to without, you know, a problematic gum surgery, for example, or removing the tooth, which is, removing the tooth is kind of the third rail of dentistry, right? If you're in politics, it's cut Medicare, and if you're in dentistry, it's pull the tooth.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Well, we'll see. Well, I guess we'll just, time will tell.
We will.
In my personal experience, if this works.
Well, keep us posted. I'd love to hear in 6 months what happened with that patient.
All right, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, we don't have time for any more calls, but we do have just a little bit of time for me to tell you about my practice. It's over on Mission Street, and I ran away from conventional medicine because I knew too many things that I couldn't implement in a conventional medicine practice. Now I have a primary care practice where we do conventional and alternative medicine. It's up to the patient to decide. It's up to me to make a case. We do a lot of support. We do a lot of lifestyle changes. And it's a way to maintain and grow your wellness and your resiliency rather than just accept that we're all going to deteriorate. Yeah, let's deteriorate as slowly as possible. Let's make that deterioration take a very long time. You can join me. Go to AskDrDawn.com and click the View Dr. Dawn's Practice. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.